Oxide Radio, Oxford University's only student-run radio station.
Hello and welcome to Oxide Radio. This is Theo Davis-Lewis, your station manager, on your current affairs show, Oxford Today. Now, we've been speaking to a wide range of people from in and around Oxford over the last few weeks, and admittedly, we actually haven't been speaking to students. But today, we are speaking to a former student who represents students now, and that is Amate Doku, who is the NUS Vice President for Higher Education. He was formerly at Cambridge University, where he was also the JCR President and the Cambridge Student Union's President in 2016 to 2017. And I'm delighted that he's here in Oxford with me. Amate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And it's always difficult, you know, when you speak to people that are involved in student politics and have been involved, because everyone has sort of a preconception, I suppose, of what a student politician looks like. Tell us about your sort of career, because you have sort of ascended the greasy pole of student politics, and you start off, you know, you started off pretty, you know, down the ranks in the JCR, but then you've got there now, haven't you? Anyways, what's the journey been like?
Well, I think it all started in must have been year 8 when I stood for the school council elections. Oh, actually, that's where it began. And well, one of the actual funny things, looking back, I found this document called School Council Reform, which I put together in year 10. That was the sort of 16-year-old I was.
That's impressive, yeah.
And I effectively was trying to turn the school council into a student union, which obviously the school wasn't too keen on, which might explain why I didn't get head boy. But I'm not not bitter about that.
Doesn't bother you anymore, does it?
Not at all. So my journey really started in second year of uni, when I ran to be president of the JCR. I'd run the year before to be finance secretary, which is probably quite fortunate that I didn't get that, because I didn't know anything about money at all.
Sounds boring as well.
Yeah, I know, it's very difficult as well, because you're balancing all the clubs and societies, and everyone gets angry at you if you make a mistake. But yeah, it was, you know, obviously diving at the deep end, but everyone in the committee was basically new. And yeah, we had a really, really good year. And then after that, finished in at the end of the year and had a couple of months off, and hadn't really thought about standing in the Central Students Union, hadn't really been involved or engaged in it at all. And then all of a sudden you sort of explore the possibility of standing in an election, and the next thing you know, you're running one, and then you win. So it was never ever sort of a careerist in that sense. Yeah. Never sort of thought of that in mind. It's sort of at every stage going, well, what's my skill set, what have I enjoyed? Student representation has been quite fun, quite interesting, very, very important. I know the importance of having good people who are able to hold the institutions to account. And then obviously going from there to NUS was another leap, which I hadn't expected either.
So you're in the NUS now for the next year, aren't you?
Yeah.
So, like, just so everyone else sort of knows what you get up to, because obviously there's a big thing which I'm sure we'll go on to again, is that just knowing what the NUS does and what the NUS stands for, because there's been loads of controversies and the like, you know, over the last 12 months especially. Mm. You know, you are the NUS Vice President for Higher Education, and, you know, you've written, first of all, on higher education tuition fees. You know, there's more questions than answers, you said. You know, is that something specifically that you want to sort of actually lobby and campaign for? You know, what's the whole remit you have?
So I've got a very, very broad remit. There are obviously around about 130 universities in the United Kingdom. The best way of really understanding my role is that we have a president, and then five vice presidents, and I'm one of the five. So there's a vice president for further education, one for welfare, one for societies and citizenship, one for union development, which is looking after student unions, and then I take on the higher education portfolio, so essentially higher education policy. And so that covers everything from tuition fees, obviously, which has been on the news quite a lot, to looking at the new higher education reforms which have just come in, and making sure that we're influencing and there, from also my own agenda, which I came in on, which looks at things like the Black Attainment Gap and all sorts of things. But on the topic of tuition fees, what I would say is that when I ran back in April, you know, it was assumed that tuition fees would go up in line with inflation. It seemed like the obvious thing to happen, because that was where the political consensus, certainly in the Conservative Party, was at the time. Since the election, we've seen a complete shift in that. And we know that, for example, the cabinet is split almost six different ways on the issue of how to fund higher education.
Yeah.
So it's very, very interesting times to be working in. And I have to say that when I ran, I hadn't expected this to be the sort of thing I speak most about on sort of media appearances.
Do they actually, you know, I assume that you obviously have a lot of contact with these sort of government organizations and departments. Do they actually listen to what you say then when you say, you know, this isn't fair, this is why, what we're going to do about it? Do they actually take that on board, do you think, or not?
So I think it's important to understand sort of the sorts of different levels of representation that we have and in different organizations. So we are, last time I checked, there are about 28 different sector committees that we have representation on, either directly with me, I sit on about 7 of them, or for the rest of them, NUS staff members or sabbatical officers who we appoint. Now, on some of those committees and some of those sector agencies, we have a lot of influence. We listen to a lot. For example, I'm on the Quality Assurance Agency Board. That is the independent body which assesses quality assurance in higher education, ensures that we have very high standards of quality in our teaching. And they are currently applying to be the designated quality body for the new government, wider government body called the Office for Students. Mm. But they also have an independent student board as well, an advisory board, which also meets, and they do listen to us. Again, it depends on which sector agency you're talking about.
Yeah.
In terms of actual government, it's sometimes harder to get traction because of the politics associated with that, and because of, well, at the moment, obviously, we know the situation the government's in, and it's quite chaotic at the moment, so sometimes it's hard to know, hard to get any influence in. But I think it depends on what issues, but we do have a lot of contacts in the sector, and a lot of people in the sector agree with us. It depends on what decisions we're talking about.
So on that note then, do you think that, because if you look back through the history of NUS, you've got some people that have gone on to politics or whatever, and, like, you know, thinking of just people on top of your head, like Peter Mandelson, for example, was NUS president back in the day. And arguably, back then, it was something that was so sort of prestigious and influential. And some might argue now that if you look at the recent crises that have been in the NUS, and perhaps the lack of action because of people don't listen to you or whatever, and they've got bigger priorities, some people might say that the NUS actually isn't something that is benefiting students, and or they just, you know, use their NUS card to get 20% off of the co-op. Do you know what I mean? This is something that people would bring up.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, students, unions as a whole have an issue with a sort of a perennial issue with engagement. I don't necessarily think this is a new problem. I don't necessarily think it's something that's arisen over the last couple of years. I think it has been for a long time. And of course, different NUS presidents, different NUS vice presidents go on to do lots of different things. So some have gone on to work in politics full time. Others have ended up working in the higher education sector. Others have ended up working in the charity sector. Others have gone into business. So there's a whole range of different things that students, unions can do. Politicians, activists, campaigners can go on to do afterwards. It's up to the individual. What I would say is that the problem and the challenges of engaging students is a perennial one. It's not something which we've necessarily cracked. But I think certainly this year, what the leadership is trying to do is to focus on the things that really matter to students, make sure that we are relevant and that we are doing everything we can to explain very, very clearly what our priorities are, what we're fighting for, and why, and ensure that we are really... we have the confidence of student unions at the very least and the wider student population that we are fighting for the things that they care about.
And you mentioned at the start, and we talked a bit about this before the interview, just generally about things like the Black attainment gap and even actual discrimination and racism we see, and we'll talk about what's happened at Oxford and Cambridge specifically over the last couple of weeks soon. But maybe if we start on anti-Semitism in higher education, because I think you had a report out last month that found that a quarter of Jewish students in the UK live in fear of anti-Semitic attacks. And, you know, obviously, you know, as decent people, not even as an activist, you know, you can't sort of comprehend it. But, you know, what does that say about our, you know, higher education system, that this sort of discrimination can happen? It's happened here in Oxford, specifically with the Labour Club, I think. You know, what can you do and what can we do to actually combat specifically anti-Semitic attacks or anti-Semitic sentiment in people?
Well, look, it's a problem across our campuses, anti-Semitism, hate crime in general, and actually xenophobia on the whole. You know, you've got to be careful that you don't necessarily compare anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and see them as the same thing. But we have to look at the xenophobia, which has been... rising on our campuses and asked why. I mean, one of the things which we've been doing, certainly some of the other officers whose remit under this under which this issue falls, have been ensuring that student unions are equipped and are setting up hate crime reporting centres so that we can actually start to track these things, and we can actually start to have a space where students, when they experiences, when they're unfortunate enough to experience this, know where to go, know where to report it. We're keeping track of it, and we're raising this as an issue. I think it's really important that when freshers come and when they start, that it's made very, very clear to them that this sort of behaviour is unacceptable. It shouldn't be tolerated. And I think we have to be much stronger in our condemnation of it. But as I said, in terms of what the NUS is doing, as I said, we've been pushing for more hate crime reporting centres. We've been making it very clear on the public stage that this is something which is not acceptable and should be clamped down on. And also, you know, internally, you may know that NUS recently did a review into institutional racism. And we are in the process of implementing all the recommendations from that.
Yeah, obviously, because it's difficult when you think about what's happened, you know, and it's, you know, it's sort of not your fault, is it? You know, what's happened over the last 12 months in NUS, and even in the NUS election recently for president, there was so much about anti-Semitism and Malia Buati and all these allegations and everything. Do you think that's made it sort of more difficult, perhaps, for like people like you and the officers to actually say, you know, also actually to be listened to then, if people say, when you talk about anti-Semitism?
Well, look, I think the leadership, the new leadership of the NUS has does have the confidence, I think, of many people in the sector. And I think what we did really do, and does have the confidence of many people in the student movement, because what we did do when we started off is we said, look, we have had quite a rough couple of years, but let's set the record straight. Let's get everyone, you know, and we did a lot of work in building up some of those relationships which may have been lost, and provide the confidence. But I think it's important to remember that certainly in terms of certainly my election and the election of the president, these were quite astounding, overwhelming majorities in the sort of 60% region. It was clear that there was time for a change of direction. You know, again, coming into this role new, you have to inject something new, some new life into it and new perspectives. And I think we've done that. And I think people do have confidence that we will be taking these things very seriously.
Well, you certainly have. You know, anyone can acknowledge that because of, you know, your just general history and politically as well. You know, I think you were the third black president of the Cambridge Students Union or something like that. And, you know, just focusing then on what some people might argue is another form of discrimination in terms of the black attainment gap and the lack of black students in Oxford and Cambridge. You know, you can look at the figures, you can look at how, you know, for the most recent, when the figures are available in 2015, Cambridge accepted 15 black male students and 23 black female students. And, you know, it's unbelievable, really. And, you know, we were we couldn't really believe it, that we were sort of celebrating the fact that there were more black students in Cambridge than Etonians. You know, we were sort of, you know, it's obviously something that's positive, but, you know, it's quite farcical that it's taken this long. So if let's focus on this sort of social apartheid that David Lammy talks about and stuff like that. You know, where does this start then? Who is to blame? Is it what we're blaming Oxford and Cambridge for everything, and it's the failed education system that's to be blamed? Or it is Oxford and Cambridge. It is the fact that there's a bias. There is a fact that, you know, black students and people from poor areas don't get the advantages that other people do. Who are we looking at to actually sort this out?
I think the important thing about this issue is that there are so many different factors involved. And I think sometimes we get drawn into who is to blame and point fingers. So what ends up happening is different parts of, you know, the education system, different parts of state, start pointing fingers at each other and saying, you're to blame, no, you're to blame, no, you're to blame. And then when people get attacked, they say, no, we're not to blame because we're doing X. And then, you know, this will keep happening year on year and year on year until somebody takes a holistic view at what's going on here. I want to make one important point. So on the Oxbridge situation, for example, you know, the reality is, taking prior attainment into account, black students are still not getting into Oxbridge with the levels that they should be, and there's also an attainment gap. Okay. But the other thing to recognise is that there aren't enough black students also getting the A-levels that would meet the threshold. Okay. And what tends to happen then is that then both sides start blaming each other. You know, Oxford and at Cambridge will say, well, it's the school system, we've accepted everyone we can, when we know that there's still a bias there. And then all the school sector or politicians who are in charge of the running of schools will say, well, you know, it's Oxford and Cambridge, they should be accepted. So you end up getting into this thing where people are pointing fingers and not actually providing any solutions. Mm. And any solutions are not based on any holistic understanding. What you've got to understand is that from primary school, from year one, from reception, black students and black minority ethnic students are discriminated against all the way through, whether that's in the, you know, subtle things like the sort of work that they're given, the amount they're praised, the amount they're challenged, the sets they're put into, how teachers perceive them to be, you know, in terms of academically, whether or not they are recommended to go down an academic path for sixth form or told, actually, you're not academic enough to go to university. You know, all these things, plus the fact that they're more likely to come from disadvantaged backgrounds, which adds a whole layer of disadvantage as well. What we're not very good at doing in this conversation is looking at the entire life cycle, essentially, a journey of a black student in this country, and at every single level they're discriminated against. So by the time they get to Oxford or to apply for Oxford and Cambridge, it's a very, very small pool you're choosing from, and even a smaller pool that actually makes its way in. I think the important thing to remember, I mean, 2 points here. The important thing to remember is, one, Oxford and Cambridge haven't done everything that they can do to rectify this problem. And I think the really important thing is that in order for them to say, actually, it's the problem of the schools or it's the problem of people not applying, that kind of thing, they need to demonstrate that they've done everything that they can do to show that, you know, both in terms of the experience of black students whilst they're here, but also in terms of the number of black academics there are teaching, and also in terms of the number of black students they're admitting, that they've done everything they can to make sure that everyone who's interviewing, everyone who's involved in the admissions process has been trained, knows it's an issue, is held accountable. But the other thing I find absolutely remarkable about this whole debate is that we're talking about the two most prestigious universities in, to some extent, the world, depending on what league tables you look at, for research. You know, where is the research into this issue? Mm. It's left to staff members, non-academic staff members, to design up widening participation schemes.
And arguably you as well, because that's what you wrote your dissertation on.
Right, 100%. And it's not, where is the resource going into funding high quality research into tackling inequality in this country? Because not only will that give Oxford and Cambridge credence to actually say, do you know what, this is where the problem lies and these are the different interventions and this is the advice that the university will take, but this is also where the school sector needs to get its act together, this is also where other, you know, the even the criminal justice system needs to get its act together, but it doesn't seem to see that as a priority. And it's this kind of divide. Obviously, as somebody who does sociology, I find it absolutely remarkable that you can call yourself the leading research institute, but that seems to be, you know, science and engineering, that kind of thing. What about social science? What about understanding your role to play within reproducing these inequalities? And I think that's where I think the conversation needs to go.
And arguably then, and in a lot of people think you make a lot of good points, because there isn't a sort of an holistic sort of approach to this. But if you look at then, if black students and ethnic minorities discriminated against, you know, throughout their academic life, how on earth are we going to get a solution? You know, that requires sort of, you know, a social and a cultural shift, surely, in this country. It's not even policy-wise. It's just, some might argue, it's just general racism, really.
Well, this is how racism works. And I think, you know, this is might sound controversial, but I think often when we talk about racism, or the public perception of racism, it's, oh, somebody said something racist to somebody else. It was on Twitter, this person said something racist, and everyone gets very angry about it. And rightly so, if somebody says something very offensive. Mm. But I think what people miss is that racism is more than that. Racism is not about the individual incident. Racism is about what happened for that individual incident to be considered racist. And, you know, the way social sciences really understand racism is to take a snapshot of society, look at who's at the top and who's at the bottom, and what you'll find is that black and minority ethnic people are disproportionately represented at the bottom of society, and that's racism. And the question is, how does that reproduce itself over time? And the education system, far from being this great leveler, is perpetuating these inequalities. So you're right, it's not something that can be done by a few quick changes in policy. It requires a wholesale examining of the entire system. You've got to look at that black student who starts in reception and what happens to them by the time they leave school. And if you don't take that holistic approach, you can't solve and redress many of these issues.
Do you need then sort of like even just sort of a political change? Do you need a leader? Do you need a party? Or anyone that's or a movement in this country to do that? Surely, you know, there needs to be sort of a whole sort of shift in the way this country works.
I mean, yeah, It does.
But is that likely, though? It's not likely, is it?
Well, I mean, for those of us who spend our lives fighting for these things, you know, it's the reason why we get involved, the reason why we become activists, the reason why we become campaigners is to not only raise these issues, but to make sure that we're fighting for them at every level. I have the privilege, for however long I do, to raise it as a profile at higher education, but I am fully aware that it requires more than that. And there are people out there who are fighting for this, and they are doing a lot of quiet, often grassroots level work. But the important thing is, how can we make sure that we put this as a priority for our government? How do we make sure that we get people elected into government who are treating this as a priority? And ultimately, you know, you can't be an ally, you can't be non-racist if you aren't actively anti-racist. And I think that's really, really important, because, as I said, when the focus is on the incident that takes place on Twitter and this person saying someone's racist grandparent, that kind of sort of narrative, it means that everybody distances themselves away from being involved in the reproduction of these inequalities. And I think that's wrong, and I think that's very dangerous.
And do you think then, if you talk about the silent majorities that are fighting for it behind the scenes and everything, you know, like if you look at David Lammy, do you think that's the right approach then, to sort of come out and sort of say this is a social apartheid? Because the criticisms of Lammy, you know, from different people in the media would sort of be like, that's a really strong word to use. You know, is that something, does his approach obviously highlights the issue, but does it actually make it better?
Look, I think David Lammy has done a lot of work over the years in tackling many of these issues, and I think he's right to be forthright and to be strong about it. I don't think there should be any beating around the bush. I think anything that can raise the profile of these issues is important. What I would say is that I think he does focus a bit too exclusively on Oxford and Cambridge. And this is the other thing. The black attainment gap isn't something that just happens at Oxford and Cambridge. Actually, the experience of black students and black minority ethnic students across higher education as a whole is one of discrimination, is one of not getting, systemic attainment gaps, is one of not feeling a sense of belonging, is one of not being taught by anybody who looks like you. And I think that's important to recognize, because what we don't want is the rest of the university sector to go back and go, well, it's just an Oxford and Cambridge problem, and not also fulfill their end of the bargain.
And then perhaps what's caused even more divide generally in this society, and I say this to everyone, it's just, you know, guess on a bit, you know, but it's probably Brexit, you know. And you're the lead guy for the NUS, and you're the main man, and you said, you know, we need a plan. You know, we need to sort this out. We need to fight for the rights of people. What can you do, you know, in the NUS to influence, you know, policies on higher education, policies on the rights of students, policies on the rights of international students to study here?
Well, we are doing a number of things at the moment, and it's important to remember that we have a lot of allies in the higher education sector who agree with us, a lot of people who think we should be fighting for to ensure that we maintain our research collaboration, to ensure that we maintain the ability for academics to travel to the UK to teach our students, and also for those transformational experiences for British students as well, going to the understanding of the importance and the real positive impact that being able to travel abroad has for an educational experience. And of course, most importantly, at the moment, given all the uncertainty, the rights of EU students who are currently studying here. In terms of, well, the reality of the situation is that it's a very complicated picture. The government is in a bit of a mess at the moment, and all sectors are struggling. Even ministers are struggling to get their view in on what the deal should look like.
You're more important than Amateur. You're the mayor.
Well, of course, you know, I like to think that.
So listen, we don't need to listen to David Davis. Amateur Doku, you know, come on, man, you're the main man. You're going to sort it out.
Well, modesty is of course a virtue. I think it's really important, though, to remember that we can sometimes get hooked up, hooked on focusing on kind of who we think are the key players. But there's a lot of there are other avenues. There are other very important avenues which we have been utilising. That's, you know, making sure that we're talking to European student leaders across Europe who also have influence over their national governments. That's making sure that universities are also continuing to talk to each other and continuing to collaborate, because I think those things will be as important, if not more important, as the deal, which is whatever deal in the short term is hashed out by the key players. Now, obviously, immigration rules will be absolutely key to shaping any future landscape, and those are things which we've been fighting for. But I think the key thing which we've been saying is that Brexit shouldn't, or the sort of the remedies to kind of mitigate Brexit shouldn't just be focused on can we keep things the same. It should be about can we make sure that we actually create an environment for future collaborations to thrive. And actually, it's a good time to really think more positively about what that relationship could look like, understanding that there could be huge challenges ahead.
Do you think, though, that we're going to go ahead with it anyway? Because you could argue that you should be campaigning for Brexit not to happen, because an NUS survey found out that two-thirds of students actually didn't want Brexit. They wanted a second referendum on Brexit. So, you know, should, you know, if you were sort of representing students, you can make the argument saying, well, actually, I'm going to campaign to say this is not happening anymore.
Well, I think our policy makes it very, very clear that whilst, you know, we campaign very hard for to remain in the European Union, we have to try and get the best deal for students. And that's currently where our policy is. Now, that might change. Yeah. And obviously, these things are very, very fast-paced. And we'll see what happens at our national conference in March next year. Mm. But I think at the moment, our plan is making sure that we make the most out of what we didn't vote for, but we understand that, you know, how can we keep as much things the same? How can we make sure that we preserve as much as we can, but also create an environment for us to continue to thrive?
But do you think this country needs to listen to young people more then? Because, you know, this, you can make the argument, you're sort of my age, you know, in our 20s and everything, you know, this isn't what the majority of young people voted for. You know, this is not the country that, you know, most people that are young people did not vote to leave. So why should we have to agree with what these people are saying in their 60s and 70s?
Well, it's right. I mean, this is a story that cuts across all the many of the other political issues facing us at the moment. I think the Brexit referendum was a real wake-up call for young people in recognising the importance of really engaging in politics, because the people who do engage are the people who get what they want out of it. And I think this most recent election really proved that. NUS did a lot of work in making sure that, you know, students were registered to vote and that they got out to vote. And we saw the result of that election. We had a party which didn't give anything to young people, really suffered as a result of that. And young people's issues, as it were put on the table. So I do think it's important. It's an absolute privilege to be in this position where I can speak on behalf of lots of students. The important thing is that we are in tune with what students want, and that we are listening for the sorts of things that students want us to fight for.
And perhaps linked to what we see with the divisions of different students at universities and political issues like Brexit, is actually who has the right to speak at universities and the freedom of speech. And, you know, you sort of shared your sort of scepticism of how the media do paint with a broad brush, really, that anyone that gets no platform is a reflection of the NUS's policies or students' union's policies. You know, do you think then that this has to be dealt by on a case-by-case basis of who is allowed to speak and who is not?
Yeah, you know, and I think this is one of those issues which, and I've said, you know, it gets overplayed, is exaggerated in the media. When I, you know, I've been to visit lots of students' unions, I've been to speak to students on the ground, I've been to speak to course representatives, and I've asked them, what are the top five issues facing students at the moment? And they never, ever, ever mention freedom of speech and no platforming as being an issue, because they're more concerned about financial issues, they're more concerned about mental health, they're more concerned about space. Is there enough space in the library? Do we have the right facilities at the time when universities are trying to recruit as many students as possible to their campuses to balance the books? And, you know, things like library space, as I, you know, reading earlier today, study spaces are a real issue there. These are the things that I prioritise, and these are the things that students need and are fighting for. This, you know, this no platforming debate, this freedom of speech, you know, it only, to be honest, is focused on certain institutions. And actually, when you actually drill into the stories and look at it, you know, look at what's happened, it's often far more nuanced, far more complicated than what it's made out to be.
And perhaps then, you know, you can look at freedom of speech and say that it's these sort of leaders in these universities themselves that say there's sort of a snowflake culture. And I think Chris Patton was here, and he was talking about how sort of even the comments of the Vice Chancellor she recently made, which was sort of misconstrued in the media, and the Vice Chancellor of the University of Oxford, you know, Louise Richardson's comments about, you know, if there was any homophobic tutors and all that, and how it got sort of played around. I think people could sort of acknowledge that what she said was, you know, misjudged, but it wasn't actually an intentional thing. But I think the point that people like Chris Patton would make is that people just react in an instant to anything, and students just have, you know, are just a bit more sensitive in these, in inverted commas. And does, are those sorts of comments not helpful, you know, to like actually the debate about, you know, who should speak? And
yeah, I mean, they're very unhelpful, and to some extent, you know, I'd wish that they would leave us alone to make our own decisions. And and sometimes I'd question many of these people, who many of whom went to university, what their actual university experience was like, because many of these people went to universities in the 60s, 70s and 80s, where students were far more engaged in political activism, where they were shutting down universities, where they were, you know, going on huge protests to fight for international peace and justice on the scale that we just don't see today. Where speakers, to you know, there are plenty of pictures of speakers being escorted in whilst crowds are campaigning outside the Oxford Union from the 70s and 80s. So this is not a new thing. And I think what has happened is that at a time when people from marginalized groups, whether they're LGBT plus, you know, black and minority ethnic, women, from traditionally disadvantaged groups start speaking out, yeah, especially sort of, we've got a new trans campaign at NUS, when these people start speaking out and saying, actually, I don't think that's right, you're not recognising my experience, I think it's unacceptable that you are perpetuating these inequalities. When they actually have get a moment to have a voice, they are completely shut down and discredited and seen as too sensitive and snowflakes. And I think that is the most dangerous thing. What we're really seeing is an attempt, for want of a better word, perhaps an accurate word, for a sort of an established culture, an established culture within these institutions, discrediting minority voices under a guise of, you know, students are too sensitive and students are snowflakes, when actually the freedom of speech of those individuals is never, ever prioritised.
Could you say then it's because maybe that students even now, even though they're not, you know, going out as radically as before, that we do actually disagree with, you know, as we say about Brexit and other issues, with adults far more than anyone? Because I think there was a recent front page of The Spectator was saying how to make sure your child doesn't grow up as a snowflake. And surely it's perhaps because that we are actually quite different to the older generations, and they're sort of threatened by it or something, you know?
Yeah, and I think we are also, the older generation are also, you know, that when they went to university, there were very, very different times. Different things were prioritised, I think, you know, on many issues, such as mental health. It was a sort of,
it's a taboo, wasn't it, really? Yeah, so it is to some extent.
Put up or shut up culture, and you know around, you know, sexual harassment and that sort of thing. I mean, these things were just not talked about. And the minute we start to raise injustices, it's misconstrued as, oh, it's students being too sensitive. And I think that is where the intergenerational divide really manifests itself. I think it's a really unhelpful narrative. And actually what we'd like to see is a bit more allyship from the older generations in trying to tackle what should be things that would benefit everyone.
Do you think as well then, you know, before we finish, that if we look at universities generally then, that they are going to change? Because Louise Richardson said in an interview recently that she doesn't think Oxford will be top in 50 years' time. And I find that sort of hard to believe, in the sense that now, you know, it's quite hard to look to the future when you've got such a arguable dominance from Oxford and Cambridge across these league tables. But do you think then that the role of Oxbridge, of universities generally, of vice chancellors and chancellors will change, and then therefore we'll see some sort of shift to the influence of students and so forth?
That's a very big question.
It's a big show, I'm going to say. All right, this is a serious discussion.
And
right?
Of course, you know, I'm very honoured to be here to tackle to solve the biggest issues in our education. Look, you know, obviously, naturally, in my job, I'm focused on the day to day, on the sort of short term. What is the government going to do next week to mess up higher education? Yeah. You know, that sort of thing. But actually, if you take a big picture, there's some huge challenges that we'll face as a country, whether it's in terms of the massive skills gap, which is increasing, whether it's in terms of, you know, automation, which is going to completely change the way we look at work and employment. Some really, really important issues, some fundamental issues about the roles of the university. And the government has one view of universities. He sees higher education, Joe Johnson, this is the Minister for Universities, sees higher education as a market, and I think students don't. And it's about which argument wins out, and that has implications for funding as well. On the Oxford and Cambridge question, I think a lot of that is tied to class. A lot of that is tied to the perception of this as part of the sort of upper middle class establishment. And if that starts to be threatened, if we start to move towards a bit more equality in that sense, you know, in line with many places in the continent which don't have class as pronounced as we do in this country, will Oxford and Cambridge start to lose some of that capital that it has just simply because of its prestige. And actually, I think Oxford and Cambridge need to start working even harder to prove that, you know, it's just because you have gowns, you've got formals and that kind of thing, that doesn't necessarily make you a better institution. You've got to demonstrate your research. You've got to demonstrate your teaching as well, rather than just recruiting to the top of society and sending them out. And, you know, we all know that family background is a much bigger determinant of future earnings than anything else at the moment. So I think that, yes, if those things do get challenged, if the establishment is getting challenged, if British society as a whole, the class structures which are so embedded in British society start to be challenged, then Oxford and Cambridge need to prove their worth beyond simply their prestige that they built up over many years. There are many institutions, many much newer institutions which are better at changing, institutions which are better at getting things done, institutions which are better than focusing on the student experience in this country than these two institutions. And I think those are the institutions which we need to look out for.
Oh, it's a very scary time, isn't it, Amate? Is
but exciting.
Exciting as well. No, thank you very much for coming in, Amate. I really appreciate it, making time for us. But what, you know, what's next then after this then? Well, you know, to give us an insight, because, you know, I see you on Sky News all the time, really jealous. And, you know, I always want to know, you know, what, you know, you talk about how people go into charity work, higher education, politics, you know, and you do get a sense that you genuinely sort of campaign for this because you want to campaign and you want to make a change. But where can you apply yourself after this then?
Well, look, I've always believed that it's really, really important if you have the ability and if you have the skills and you have the drive to fight for change and you have the privilege to do so, you should. And that is something that I will continue doing. I cannot see myself working in an institution or an organization which isn't trying to be progressive, isn't trying to change. And I certainly didn't view my education as a route to gain lots of money for that to be an end in itself. So I will do whatever I can, you know, given the constraints of being a millennial and not being able to afford anywhere to live, but to do what I can to keep fighting to challenge inequality wherever it rears its head.
Amate Doku, thank you very much for coming in. That's all we've got time for, because he's so busy all the time, he hasn't got enough time for us. No, to be fair, thank you very much for coming in. There's so much more to come this term. You've got a great lineup. And we should be getting more students on, shouldn't we? We need to get more students.
Of course,
because
absolutely.
It's not just about listening to, you know, the director of a museum or the chancellor of the university, because as you've heard today, you know, it's not about them, it's about the students.
We're the future.
Yeah, stop it with this. Stop. We're gonna cut this off before it gets too cliche. We start, you know, putting up posters here or something, you know, and trying to lead a campaign. Because I'll probably be interviewing Amate in a few years' time on some program, and you know, I'll say to him, I knew this would happen. But no, brilliant. Thank you so much for coming in. That's all we've got time for today on Oxide Radio, the university's only student-run radio station. I've been Theo Davis Lewis. Thank you again to the NUS Vice President for coming in. But from everyone here at Oxford today, goodbye.
Oxide Radio, online and on demand. Listen back to all your favorite shows on oxideradio.live.